On Tuesday, the 2019 Academy Award nominations were announced, and the field included some notable milestones. Yalitza Aparicio, the star of Alfonso Cuarón's Roma, became the first Indigenous woman to ever be nominated for Best Actress. Black Panther earned the first Best Picture nomination for a superhero movie. And more than three decades into his career, Spike Lee finally got his first Best Director nod for Black Klansman. Green Book also had a good Tuesday, earning five nominations, including Best Picture, Best Actor, and Best Original Screenplay. The film is based on the true story of Dr. Don Shirley, an accomplished black pianist who rode through the Deep South in 1962 with a white driver, Tony Vallelonga.
Dear Dolores, D-E-A-R, this is an animal. As I'm writing this letter, I'm eating potato chips, and I'm starting to get thirsty. You know this is pathetic, right? Tell me what you're trying to say.
I don't know. Yeah, well, I miss her.
Then say that. But do it in a manner that no one else has ever done it before.
It's the type of film that Oscars voters typically love to honor, but the film has also been mired in controversy, particularly about its historical accuracy and what some critics are calling a feel-good approach to race relations. For more on the film, I'm joined now by two critics. Rafer Guzman is our film critic for Newsday and The Takeaway. Welcome, Rafer.
Hi, Tanzina.
And Cameron Collins is a film critic for Vanity Fair. Welcome to the show, Cameron.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So let's get started on these light topics, race and movies. Rafer, for those who haven't seen the film. I mean, a little bit about the story here. The Green Book itself, right, was a tool for Black Americans to use to stay safe when they were traveling. There is a historical lack, I think, in the film, right? So, Rafer, can you sort of talk us through that?
I think Green Book was really just a good name. I think it's a good title for the film. It kind of hooks you and gets you in. It gives you a little bit of, once you know what it is, it gives you a little bit of sense of history, you know, this idea that African Americans at the time had to use this book to find out where they could and could not stay, where they could get a drink, where they could sleep, et cetera. That's interesting, and it evokes the time and it evokes the place pretty well. It doesn't really figure into the story almost at all. There may be one or two scenes, I think, where you can see them flipping through the Green Book, and that's really about it. It's really mostly about the story of Don Shirley, the musician, and Tony Lip, as he's called, the driver.
Cameron, why? Because that seems to be one of the biggest critiques of the film, among many, was that it did not focus on the heaviness, the sort of historical importance of the Green Book.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's sort of an implicit part of the story insofar as you assume that every sort of motel that they stay at is a Green Book approved place. This is sort of it's sort of like a, I don't want to call it like a black Yelp, but it is a sort of a way of keeping track. Just, I mean, you know, Jim Crow laws, even after they ended, the mentality persisted. So you definitely have a black character who is very aware of that. This is why he hires a sort of, you know, a bouncer from the Copacabana to drive him through sundown towns, these places where after dark you just as an African American do not want to be, which still exist. It's implicit, but it's not really a factor in the story, I don't think.
Rafer, what about the people who were behind the film? Apparently, it's the real-life son of Tony Vallelonga, who is the driver, right?
That's right, Nick Vallelonga, his son, who wrote the story because, and again, there's been a little controversy about this, but he felt that this was a really formative experience for his father and that afterwards, his father and Don Shirley, the musician, had been lifelong friends. And Don Shirley's family has come out and said that's not true, although I think they're are others that have testified to that. There's a documentary, I think, on this subject, and others have said that they were. That's a little bit, I guess, up in the air. You know, who know what lifelong friend, dear friend, I don't know. But they seem to have maintained a connection. They seem to certainly have been through something. And then, of course, as people may or may not know, it's Peter Farrelly, who's one of the co-writers and one of the directors, the guy behind Dumb and Dumber and Kingpin. So a real surprise. And a real surprise, I think, for him to, have done this film, his first sort of real heartfelt kind of issues-based drama that I don't think anyone expected of him. And then for the Oscars to respond so well to it, they really love this film.
Cameron, but who else is responding to this film? Because I keep thinking about Dr. Shirley's family.
Right.
Have they, you know, weighed in on the historical accuracy or lack thereof of the film?
They have in multiple interviews, including a great piece at IndieWire. People have been reaching out to them ever since. I mean, I have to say, when I first saw the movie, did not know that Nick Vallelonga was one of the writers. When I found that out, something clicked about the movie. But after the movie came out and more people were talking about this issue, the Shirley family has been a bit more open and a bit more open about, you know, going to screenings, whether or not they were invited, whether or not anyone talked to them, what resources could possibly have been used. And Nick Vallelonga's story is that he did speak with Dr. Shirley, and Dr. Shirley had sort of caveats about what he wanted. He didn't want this movie made until after he died, for example. And so it's, you know, for me, it's not even just a matter of accuracy. I think my takeaway is that whatever the relationship was between these two men, it is much more interesting than that movie.
It's also coming at a time where we're seeing, as we mentioned at the top, Spike Lee is getting his first director nom for BlacKkKlansman. Black Panther is out there. I mean, the Oscars are still relatively pretty white. Rafer, you mentioned that the film Green Book gave you a sense that it was a very straightforward sort of take on race relations in many ways. And Cameron, you've written about the first film that comes to mind is Driving Miss Daisy when you
right.
think about this. Tell us a little bit about the reaction to Driving Miss Daisy winning the Oscar, I suppose. And
right.
then we could take it from there on your great piece.
Well, it's interesting because these things are so difficult to measure, in part because Driving Miss Daisy and Do the Right Thing, which came out the same year, came out at a much different moment for the Oscars. This is something that I discovered in my reporting for this piece, just that, you know, this is pre-screeners. This was an era when if you wanted to see a movie, you had to go to a screening if you were in the Academy, that the movie's not going to come to you. And when you think of it in those practical terms, the sorts of choices that people make about which movies to see become more complicated because, for example, my impression, and I'm getting this partially from Mark Harris, the great film historian and film writer, is that, for example, with Do the Right Thing, you have it come out at Cannes, come out at the Cannes Film Festival, and already there you have people writing pieces suggesting that it could cause riots. Right. And this is pre-LA riot, right? This is like a before really everything came to a head. But so when you think about that and you think about the multiple pieces that were written in New York Magazine about the movie, both from Joe Klein and the film critic David Denby, that also suggested that there were political implications here that were in some way sort of racially dangerous. You think about that and then you think about the Academy voter who has to go from those to go see the movie. I think to answer your question more directly, the response to Driving Miss Daisy winning really depends on who you ask. I think among younger Academy members and certainly among the black public, it's an embarrassment. It is wild to watch these films back to back and to realize that they were made in the same year, even just aesthetically, in terms of style, in terms of acting, in terms of vision. It is remarkable to watch them back and back and say, wow, this was 1989.
I also want to get your take on this idea of the white savior film,
sure.
right? The white savior
sure.
character in film. These films today can feel sort of lacking, right?
Right?
We've come so far. And when you look at a film like BlacKkKlansman, whether you liked it or didn't like it, I still think it took the conversation a little further.
Yeah, audiences of color are fed up with this because it is the predominant narrative, particularly for actors of color. If you think about the great actors of color throughout history, generally when they were employed, for example, if you were a black woman, you were going to be a maid. If you were a black character in a sort of buddy movie, like as Sidney Poitier was for too many movies, and he felt so as well, you were going to play the kind of role that Mahershala Ali plays in Green Book. I will say in Green Book's favor that what's interesting and I think what should have been used more is the class difference, which also comes up in other, you know, in Driving Miss Daisy, you have a rich Southern white woman and her driver. There's a steep class difference there. And in Green Book, you have the black person as the rich character, the literate character, the one with the apartment over Carnegie Hall. And things like that are just like, I don't need him to be the main character of the movie. I appreciate someone wanted to take their father's stories and turn them into a movie. I have no qualms about that. And I have no qualms about Tony Lip being a sort of interesting side character who gets his own movie. I think this, you know, in terms of movies, the side characters are often the most interesting people. But why did this have to be a sort of, mutual betterment. I'm going to make you feel better about your blackness. You're going to be caught doing something homosexual and I'm not going to care somehow. you know, things like that. It doesn't add up. And I think for a black audience member, for audience members of color broadly, just we are so tired of that.
Let's pivot for a minute here, because Cameron, you did bring up a good point. There was some breaking news today in the film world. Bohemian Rhapsody, the film about Freddie Mercury, also got 5 Oscar nominations, and that was also a contentious production, if you will.
Yes.
Bryan Singer, the movie's director, who was fired midway through the production. It's reported today that there are allegations of sexual assault by 4 men who were all underage at the time. I would love to hear both of your reactions to this news and whether or not, what impact this could have or not on a film that's Oscars seem to love, but audiences seem to be mixed on.
I would actually say sort of the opposite. Although the Bohemian Rhapsody, the funny thing about this movie is that it has been critically panned, not unanimously, but the bad reviews have been so bad that I think they have overshadowed the fact that Bohemian Rhapsody has actually played really well with audiences.
Really?
I think it got an A cinema score. It has done very well overseas. That thing has been a success.
Really
and,
has.
And while nobody was looking, you know, that's why it stole the Golden Globe. You know, none of us were paying attention, really, myself included. And so much so that nobody was really talking about the fact that there have been simmering allegations about Bryan Singer for a very, very long time.
I have to say, between Green Book and Bohemian Rhapsody, I'm actually a bit more upset about Bohemian Rhapsody being nominated, because I think about it in the context of Me Too. I think that male victims are seeing the nomination of this movie and perhaps rightly thinking, you know, if this had happened in the context of, you know, the women victims that we've been talking about in relationship to the Me Too movement, everyone would have known better. I think
known it, better to what?
Known better than to sort of put Bohemian Rhapsody on a ballot. Because I think, you know, it doesn't matter that no trial has happened. It matters that these allegations have been brewing for many years.
Yeah.
And BuzzFeed has done pieces on it, in addition to sort of all the rumors in Hollywood that I'm sure people have been hearing about. This is an open secret. I have friends who only recently entered the industry who already have come into contact with some Singer associates and have already said that they're being sexually harassed. Things like this are just open secrets to me. So it is very disappointing to think that that was not a part of people's calculus. You know, Green Book is just a matter of taste and a matter of politics too. But Bohemian Rhapsody, I really think it's embarrassing. And I think the more that these Singer allegations come out, the more articles that are being written, it's going to look even more embarrassing. It really is really a shameful, I think, thing, frankly.
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and The Takeaway, and Cameron Collins, film critic for Vanity Fair. Thank you both for joining us for this fantastic conversation.
Thanks, Tanzina.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.